You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, tonight we're going to be looking at the subject of death, how not to deal with death, as is seen in chapter 3. Solomon says, "There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, and a time for war, and a time for peace." So says Solomon in the first 8 verses of chapter 3. What are we to make of this here? Is this a positive section? Perhaps you've noticed some of these lines have appeared in popular literature, popular music, books. Many titles of books have been stolen from Ecclesiastes 3. Consequently, many people think that this is just beautiful poetry. What Solomon is doing here is showing us just these beautiful, what they call merisms. You know, I love you from your head to your toes. You know, a time to love and a time to hate and everything in between. A time to mend and a time to kill and everything in between. And so Solomon is basically giving us this big kaleidoscopic view of what life is supposed to be like. And so people say this is beautiful. You've heard the song, I'm sure. Nobody? Okay, you get the idea. All right, so this was a number one hit song December 4th, 1965 on the Billboard records, making it itself a record for having the oldest lyrics to be a number one hit song. So Solomon had a number one hit 3,000 years in advance. Unbelievable. Well, is this positive? I don't think this is positive. I could be wrong, but this is wisdom literature, right? And so people will say this is wisdom literature. There was a shift in chapter 2, verse 24, where Solomon kind of, as I argued, kind of lifted up the veil to show that it's not all dark and depressing and just under heaven, under the sun, and everything's terrible. And so commentators will say that things shifted, and this is really just wisdom literature. See, I have a problem with that. If it's wisdom literature, what is it supposed to be teaching us? See my point? I hope you do. Like, wisdom literature is supposed to make you wise. All this does is say there's a time to love and a time to hate. And you're like, so which one is which? And when are we supposed to hate? Like, when did that come in? There's a time to kill and a time to heal. How is this making us any wiser? Answer, it isn't. These are also mutually destructive claims. They're merisms. They kind of cover from one end of the pole to the other end of the pole. But they're kind of wiping each other out. I would argue that what we're seeing here is that Solomon is saying, there's a time to be born. It's a girl. It's a boy. But then there's a time to die. So you come right from the hospital and then you return to the hospital. There's a time to plant. Hey, I just planted a garden. Ah, those squirrels, they uprooted everything that I planted. There's a time to heal. And then there's a time to send them right back out into the country for them to be killed. There's a time to build up and a time to tear down. Everything that we built was torn away and torn to its foundations. A time to laugh, and this is so great, except there's times for weeping. So even as you're exhilarated and excited by the times of happiness and thrills, these are also the times that you have to realize it's going to be bad and probably relatively soon. If you picked up the note in verse 1, we're still under heaven. Remember, that's been the theme of Solomon's work. We're under the sun, we're under heaven, which is basically a prepositional phrase from Solomon to say we're thinking about life apart from God, under heaven, under the sun, not with God in the picture. This makes sense of verse 9 and 10. So if you're following me here, the context make sense of what I'm saying, both before and after and in between. And we're seeing that it doesn't actually make sense to think of this as positive. So in verses 9 and 10, we see that this leads to toil and burden. What do workers gain from their toil? Verse 9. Verse 10, I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. So no, I don't think this is positive. I think this is toil and a burden. Yet, here is where I think Solomon does kind of pull back the curtain, where it's under the sun, it's under heaven, we're looking at life apart from God, and yet he pulls it back just a little bit to give us a view toward the conclusion he's going to reach in chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. He does this throughout the book. I believe that one of those times is here. He writes this in verse 11. God has made everything beautiful in its time, or appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. So even as he's looking at the microscopic, if there's a time for this and a time for just the opposite, and a time for this and a time for just the opposite, time for good and a time for evil, he says there's also something above time itself, which stretches out into eternity. Yet there's even a tension here as well. He says, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Have you felt this tension? Do you see what he's saying? You have the sense that you're in time, that we're moving through temporal events, that I'm getting older, that I'm moving from one age to another. I'm somewhere between being born and dying. And yet I also have a sense, what would you call it, that there's life after life. There's life after death. And this is going to continue on into the future. Does my life count for something in the end? What does it all mean? What does it all matter? Am I part of some sort of plan? Does any of this mean anything? So from one perspective, you could say, I get the sense that I am an eternal being, that if I die, I continue to live on into eternity future. And yet there's another sense in which I'm only like a little worm, you know, going down a stretch of highway, one little millimeter at a time. And I can't see, how's he put it? No one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I'm so close to the dry erase board that I can't see the entire math equation. But to be able to step back and to see it in its entirety, this is only for God to know and for us to eventually learn. We jump forward to verse 16. The curtain closes. Just when we get a little bit of respite from all of this pessimism and nihilism. It doesn't matter. Everything's meaningless. It's futile. It's vanity. It's in vain. We go right back to futility and vanity and the nothingness. He says in verse 16, I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. I said to myself, God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. I also said to myself, as for humans, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Wait a minute, where's he going with this? Did Charles Darwin pick up the pen here? Basically, we're just all contiguous with one another, just all animal species from, as one person put it, from the goo to the zoo to you. Well, he continues. He says, surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. Did I stutter? No. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, the animals, so dies the other, humans. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless. So just in case you think he's making some kind of like, you know, profound point, he's like, my point is, animals and humans, you know, we might not live like animals, but we surely die like animals. We rot, we decompose, and we become worm food, and that's it. All go to the same place, all come from dust, and to dust all return. You see what he's saying? He's saying we came from nothing, and we go to nothing, therefore we are nothing. We came from dust, which is worthless. We go to dust, which is worthless. And so we are dust, which is worthless. Who knows, he asks, if the human spirit rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth. Remember I said that Solomon, he's the Koheleth. He's drawing a crowd, so to speak. The word kahal in Hebrew means a crowd or a gathering. This would be equivalent of like a TED talk where he's getting a crowd together and he's pressing people's presuppositions and what they think about the world to force them to think about life. So rather than just saying, you know, that there is life after death, or you really should think about life after death, what does he do? He takes a different approach. He puts the screws to us. And he says, we are basically just like the animals. Prove me wrong. Right? Disprove me. If I'm wrong, disprove me. And he's saying, who knows? Who could say that our spirit goes up to heaven and an animal just dies and that's the end of it? He says in chapter 7, verse 2, picking up on this theme, better to spend your time at funerals than at parties. Really? After all, everyone dies, so the living should take this to heart. What's he getting at here? For somebody to go to a funeral, this is where you get your real insights, your realizations into life and what it's all about. Let me put it this way, to put it in modern terms. Do you get more insights on trips to Hawaii or trips to the hospital at 3 a.m.? Like, when's the last time you got back from a Hawaii trip and you just said, wow, I just feel like my entire life has changed. Like, this, my whole view of the world has just been completely shapen and transformed. No, it's usually through these times where you see the ultimate face to face. He says in verse 4, a wise person thinks a lot about death, while a fool only thinks about having a good time. Interesting to think about that. Now, here we are getting into some wisdom literature. Why would he say such a thing? Because if we are eternal beings, this means that we're going on into eternity future, progressively toward the infinite. And if that's true, if that really is the case, then we should prepare for that next life. Think about it like this. Suppose I gave you two options. Option number one is that you get to have your loved ones live to see you die by an accident or by murder or by a disease. Or option two, you get to live long enough to see your loved ones die by an accident, by murder, or by disease. This is going to happen. It's one or the other. And here's the worst part. You don't get to choose. This is just going to happen. This is life. Many people think that the life expectancy is the life guarantee. So they read the life expectancy is 78 years. Yeah, that's the life. That's what you can expect, but not what is guaranteed. We have no idea when our number is going to be called, and that's it. There is no guarantee. Every single day we live is lived by the mercy of God. I don't deserve to be waking up in the morning this morning. I don't deserve my next breath. I don't deserve my blood pump in my chest to be working, pumping out, you know, millions of gallons of blood to keep me alive. Every single day I live is lived by the mercy of God. And eventually, our time is going to be up. It's going to be over. Oh man, these secular thinkers, by that I mean those who don't believe in God or those who don't believe we can know God, either, you know, atheists or agnostic thinkers, like Luc Ferry, a French secular philosopher. He writes, a human knows that he will die and that his near ones, those he loves, will also die. Consequently, he cannot prevent himself from thinking about this state of affairs, which is disturbing and absurd and almost unimaginable. The quest for salvation without God, writes Ferry, is at the heart of every great philosophical system, and that is its essential and ultimate objective. That's a profound statement to be made by such a profound thinker as Luc Ferry, a French philosopher. He's saying that at the heart of every philosophical system, worldview, they're trying to come to terms with this, salvation apart from God. See, in Christianity, he's going to argue later, it fits. It makes sense. You know, we continue to move on into the future. But every other worldview is trying to answer this question, how do we get past the despair in the finality of death? Zygmunt Bauman, a sociologist and philosopher, he says, the horror of death is the horror of the void, and it is bound to remain traumatic. This has a traumatizing effect on people. When they discover, when they realize, when it finally sinks in, they are going to be looking up at the ceiling one day, taking their final breaths. They're going to be looking up at the sky, taking their final breaths, realizing it's going to be over within seconds. It's dramatic to realize that this is coming in your future. That this isn't some kind of a probability that we're speaking of here. This is a certainty. This is coming into your life. This is one of the most certain facts of your existence. Irvin Yalom, he's an Epicurean philosopher and psychiatrist. He says, I share the fear of death with every human being. It's our dark shadow from which we are never severed. despite the staunchest, most venerable defenses, we can never completely subdue death anxiety. It is always there, lurking in some hidden ravine of the mind. According to Yalom, he's saying that, basically death anxiety is there always. We're always thinking about this. We're always one, but we're suppressing it. We're not thinking about it, but we are, but we aren't, but we are, but we aren't. So if you asked any person any given day, are you thinking about your death? They would say no. But he's saying, as a professional psychiatrist, that seeing tens of thousands of people, that this is there beneath the surface at all times. Edwin Schneidman, who's a thanatologist, Thanatos, or maybe Thanos, you know, from that movie. Death means death in Greek. Thanatologist means a studier of death, and he's 90 years old, so he's about to be death pretty soon. He writes this, to cease as though one had never been, to exit life with no hope of living on in the memory of another, to be expunged from history's record, that is a fate literally far worse than death. Think of what this would be like. I'm going to make a reference here. Maybe you've seen this film, Men in Black, not the sequel or the third one, which no one should ever see. There was no fourth one, and we will never talk about it again. The first one, very, very good film. This is actually a picture from the third. Anyways, my point is, they had that little device. Remember that device where they would, you know, put it up, Tommy Lee Jones or Will Smith or whomever would hold it up to people and, you know, put the shades on, and what would it do? It would erase people's memories. I always thought that was kind of a cool little gadget. Like, wouldn't that be cool if you could just, you know, you screwed something up and just boop, you know, you're just done and you can totally read. But just think about this for a second. Imagine if someone could come through and erase you, every memory of you, from every person in your life. At first, you might say that's actually kind of cool because I could get rid of some of those embarrassing moments and those would go away. Here's the problem. It would all go away. All of it. So every friend, every loved one, every girlfriend, every boyfriend, every teacher, every professor, every coach, every guidance counselor, everyone, when they saw you, they wouldn't recognize who you are. They wouldn't have a single memory of you. They wouldn't remember the laughter. They wouldn't remember the inside jokes. They wouldn't remember times of grieving together. They wouldn't remember times of exhilaration and fun. They wouldn't remember times of love and forgiveness and closeness. What if that was all, in the words of Schneidman, completely expunged from people's memories? Wouldn't that be sickening to consider? And what if all of their memories, in your mind, were equally expunged? What if we were all expunged? Well, as you can see here, this isn't science fiction. This is the future for each one of us. It's going away forever. All of our acts of compassion, all of our memories, all of it is going away forever. There will be no memory of you. Hence, he says, it is a fate literally far worse than death. Oh, that is a horror beyond all comprehension, to think that everything I've ever done is erased, wiped off the face of the earth. And so we have different solutions that people have given to deal with this traumatic, horrific despair of death. The first is denial. I remember being a kid, and my dad used to chase me around the house, and, you know, fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of a Rochford son. And I would run upstairs, and I'd put my hands over my eyes, and I would slightly pee in my pants over in the corner. And, you know, he would pound, pound, pound. And I had this idea, like, if I couldn't see him, he couldn't see me, and you know what I mean? And I wasn't the smartest kid, but that's how I felt. And you might say, boy, that was really stupid. It is really stupid. You know what's even stupider? You know what's even more stupid? Denying death. Being a little 5-year-old kid covering his eyes. Okay, maybe you could give me a pass on that. But denying the horror of death, which is right in front of you, okay? It's on its way into your life. This is one of the most certain facts of your existence, that you will die. And just to deny it, just to not even think, you've just never thought about it. So where do you think you go when you die? What do you think happens when you die? I've never thought about it. That is denial of death. That is almost as absurd as the concept of death itself. What about another solution? To join some kind of a good cause. This is really a part and parcel of our generation. When they die, they leave the world a better place. That's cool. I'm going to come back and I'm going to repeat all this at the end. But for now, I just want you to look at this from a perspective of a universe without God, a universe under the sun, under heaven, without God in the picture. Joining a good cause means nothing. It means nothing. Here's Ecclesiastes 4:1. I observed all the oppression under the sun. I concluded that the dead are better off than the living. But most fortunate of all are those who are not yet even born. They have not seen all the evil that is done under the sun. Now, there are some people listening to me say this. I'm just reading Solomon here. And you're saying, well, that's not quite true, because I think when you're part of a good cause, it actually affects people, and it matters, because it matters to them. It matters to the people for whom you're caring and loving. It matters because it matters to those people. Skeptics will also say this exact same thing. When they go through suffering, when they're on the other end of it, they'll say this thing right here. I wish I was never born. You know, nobody told me that I could have existence. I wish I didn't have existence. I wish I was never popped into existence. I wish God never created me. Why did he create me? So which is it? Do you want to have a noble cause that can help people in suffering? Or do you want to say, I don't actually want to exist at all? Philanthropic causes. So phileo, meaning to love in Greek, and anthropos, meaning human, man. Philanthropic causes, they don't as much prolong life as they do postpone death. Philanthropic causes are like hospice. They're like hospice. There's no cure. We're not ending this thing well. The ship is going down. And as it's going down, you know, we fix the boiler. So instead of going down in 10 minutes, well, it's going to go down in 20 minutes. You know, hooray. We're not going to explode. Instead, we're going to drown to death in the Pacific. We're prolonging the inevitable. That's all we're doing here. Think about this. Imagine you're looking out of your, you know, plane and you see this. What is it? Starboard? Port side. Thanks. Nerd. Sorry, we're friends. Anyways. You look out port side and you see this in one of the engines. All right? So you pause and then you hear the captain come over, you know, this is your captain and the plane is about to explode. And you think to yourself, man, you know what I should really do? I should be part of a cause on this plane to really help other people. And you do that. You do that. And then you look at other people and they're just like, you know, pounding the vodka and the little tiny, you know, whiskey bottles. And, you know, but you're like, no, I'm going to be really noble on my way down here. And so you are like really kind to your fellow passengers. And you know what it ends up in? Like the final analysis on the plane? You know what it looks like? It looks like this. But the people who are like really cruel, like those people, like that you were looking at, that were like beating up their fellow passengers and taking their money and, you know, drinking all the alcohol and getting boozed up. You know what the final picture is for them? It looks like this. It's the same. It all ends the same. Like there might be a little bit of minutia that's different. Like the glass bottles are cracked open a little bit more than they would have been in the wreckage. Maybe some forensics, you know, nerd looks at that and says, oh, it's a little bit different. But in the end, what did it change? What did it change? Answer, nothing. It changed nothing. Good causes. No. Without God in the picture here, we are just biological machines that are doomed to die. And that's it. Distractions. We can get into distractions. Yeah, I mean, I guess this could kind of fool us. This would be kind of like a noble lie where we could distract ourselves from this. But this wouldn't actually deal with the fear of death itself. Here was one study that was done where at a university they gave flyers to half of a group of people. And in group number one, the flyer said that they could give them help with their back pain. And in group number two, they said, we will give you help with your fear of death. You with me? Back pain in one group, fear of death in the other. Then a few yards down the line, they had a booth that served alcoholic or non-alcoholic beverages. And you had to pay. It wasn't like it was free to be in the study. Flyer, and then you get to pay. You want, you know, something alcoholic or non-alcoholic. For those who got the flyer for the back pain, 9% chose the alcoholic beverage. For those who got the flyer for the help with the fear of death, 37% got the alcoholic beverage. That's four times the, and I know you're like, okay, so what is this trying to prove? That we shouldn't drink alcohol? Oh dear God, you're so dense. Stick with me here. The point here is this is a flyer. It's a piece of paper that has letters on it and you give it to the person and they're like, I don't want to think about that. That's scary. Thinking about the fear of death. Fourfold. Went right for the alcohol just so they wouldn't have to think about this whole prospect. Boy, this is really hard to enjoy yourself too. When you're thinking about the reality of death, oh, I'm going to distract myself with all these different things in my life, with death hanging over your head. How Can you enjoy yourself? You guys seen that movie Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler? Boy, was he good in that movie. Not as good as Hubie Halloween, but close. I mean, he was like, how did you feel when you watched that movie? The whole time you're just feel like he's going out and he's going crazy, drugs, and he's got a woman on the side, and he's really going for it. But the whole time, the bookies are coming after him, ready just to break his legs, you know, snap his neck. At one point, I don't want to give away too much. I will. They throw him in a trunk and stuff, and they're going to take away and kill him and stuff. And the whole time, the whole freaking movie, you're just sitting there thinking, how can you enjoy yourself knowing that these bookies are going to pop out from behind the alley at any moment, and you're going to die a gruesome, butchered death? Like, how do you enjoy your life, even as a rich person, even as a powerful person? So too, how can we enjoy our lives when we're sitting here looking at the certainty of death? It's not like we can escape the bookie. Eventually, there's going to be a bookie there at the end of that alley that we can't escape. This is going to, it's on its way. What about career? Some people just get lost in their career. For them, it's like, this is also a distraction. I would say, yeah, that's got to be it. Because if you can get into your career, you can really feel like that's the thing that makes me happy. And sometimes you're in a career that actually benefits people. It's not just, you know, making lots of money or something like that. So you have the feelings of joy, happiness of giving out to other people, and at the same time, it keeps you busy. The problem is people that make their lives their career, they become very competitive, for one, constantly competing with other people, their own colleagues, their own friends. Or if that's not their route, they become very one-dimensional kind of people. Like when you talk to them, what is there to talk about? All they want to talk about is their freaking job. And nobody cares about their job. You know what I mean? It's like, it's cool. I want to hear about your work and stuff. But isn't there another part of you that we could talk about at all? So this becomes very dehumanizing when all you are is what you do. When all you are is what you do. Like when you go to a party, what's your name and what do you do? That's all you are to me is what's your name and how do you function? Okay. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Career. Does this answer the problem? No, doesn't answer the problem at all. Leonard Woolf, husband of Virginia Woolf, politician, author. I mean, talk about educated, academic, in the political arena for half a century. I mean, this guy had the height of his career, absolutely. At the end of his life, in his autobiography, he said, what was the use of all that work? Was it of the slightest importance? Did it achieve anything substantial of what it was intended to achieve? Looking back at the age of 88, over the 57 years of my political work in England, knowing what I aimed at and the results, I see clearly that I have achieved practically nothing. The history of the human anthill during the last 57 years would be exactly the same as it is if I had played ping pong instead of sitting on committees and writing books in memoranda. I have therefore to make the rather ignominious confession that I must have, in a long life, ground through between 150,000 and 200,000 hours of perfectly useless work. He isn't even dead yet at the time of this writing, and he's looking back realizing, how much did I affect? Really not that much. And the ants are going to keep going on marching, and nothing's really going to change. What about health and fitness? There's all these books out there. You've probably read some of these, maybe. I don't know. Adele Davis, Let's Eat Right to Keep Fit. Montignac, that was a French cookbook or whatever. Younger Next Year, very famous. The Complete Book of Running by Jim Fix. These are all bestsellers. That's why I pick them. I also pick them to show that these people all died earlier than the life expectancy. Adele Davis died of cancer, just like the rest of us. Died of cancer at age 66. Montignac, the Frenchman. Younger Next Year, died of cancer, age 58. Jim Fix died on a run, age 52. Think about that. You know, when you go out, like, and you see people, like, in sweats and, like, jogging outside, and you think that's normal? Like, you think that's really normal? That's not normal. You know what changed that? Jim Fix. That's who changed that. He was the guy who was, he was very obese. He got into jogging. He was on commercials, had book deals, interviews. And he was teaching people how to get in shape and stuff and made jogging normal. Before Jim Fix, if people saw you jogging, they'd say, you're a psycho. Who jogs? Like, who? That's weird. Jim Fix made it normal. Died on a run. Now, my point here isn't to be like, don't work out, right? Any more than I would say, don't get into philanthropic causes. Or you'll see even more as we continue. My point is, This doesn't cure death. People neurotically in the gym just thinking, I got to stay in perfect health. I could eat the perfect food. It's got to be in a whole foods, antioxidants and everything. And yeah, take care of your body. That's a biblical concept. Absolutely. But the idea that we're going to sit there and we're going to fix death, we're not even getting close here. We're adding a couple years. Other people, their solution to the denial of death is to have kids. Solomon faces this, squares up on it. Chapter 2, verse 18, he says, I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave it to others everything I have earned. And who can tell whether my successors, whether they'll be wise or whether they'll be foolish? Yet they will control everything I have gained by my skill and hard work under the sun. How meaningless. Solomon had 700 concubines. He had 300 wives. He only has one son who's ever mentioned in the scriptures, a boy by the name of Rehoboam. Rehoboam shattered Solomon's life's work. And you wonder if when he was writing this here, if he was thinking to himself, God, I built all this stuff. I have all the vineyards and the singers and the gold and everything, and I got to leave it to him? He's an idiot. He's going to blow it all apart. Sure enough, he did. Yeah, why are you working so hard? Oh, I'm working for my kids, man. I want to leave something for my kids. Who among us would say that leaving a big, big chunk of money to your kids is necessarily a good idea? I've heard reports of people getting a big inheritance. It's one of the worst things that ever happened to them. Drug addiction, blowing their money, not being able to handle money responsibly. This could actually damage your kid. You ever thought about that? Regardless, if we're saying my meaning in life is to have kids, what if you never have kids? That means you never had meaning. Refute my logic. If you're saying the meaning of life is to have kids and you're not able to have kids, then you have no meaning. That's what you're saying. How about this? You do have kids. The 10th generation from you, they're going to have 0.05% of your DNA. You know what that's similar to? Zero. Zero DNA. They won't even know. There'll be nothing in them that you'll be even able to tell it was you. If meaning comes from my kids, then really what I'm trying to do is have kids to exploit them for their meaning. I'm not having kids to love the child. I'm having kids to take my meaning from them. Let me tell you something. That is a recipe for raising a terrible child. When mom and dad are looking to their own kid to take meaning and suck meaning out of them. I remember my buddy was a real hockey star because his dad used to drive him, you know, every day, 5 a.m. to hockey, 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 hockey. Finally, I asked his dad, I was like, so did you ever play hockey? No. Did you play football or something? Real big guy. Yeah? No. You play any sports? No. No sports. But he drove his kid right off the brink to sports. It's like everybody could see he was living vicariously through his own son. Damaging, very painful for children. What about emotional detachment? You know, when we think about our lives, what is it that makes it meaningful? It's not our money. We argued that already last week. It's not pleasure. You could be suffering and have a lot of meaning. You could be going through a lot of pleasure and have no meaning. So those aren't even the same at all. What makes life meaningful is love. Love relationships. But this is the very thing that's being ripped from us at death. So some worldviews, their solution is actually just to detach yourself from your loved ones so that when they die, you don't feel the pain, the despair, depression. Here's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. This is her book, very famous, On Death and Dying, The 5 Stages of Grief. That was her. She says this, though. She says, the terminally ill will reach a stage during which he is neither depressed nor angry about his fate. See, I thought this was good, that the final stage is acceptance. And I always thought that was good. It's not good. She writes, acceptance should not be mistaken for a happy stage. It is almost void of feeling. According to her, when you get to the acceptance stage, this is where you become completely numb. You don't care. You don't want to see your family. You've accepted it. And all you want to do is die. Well, if this is the solution, basically, something very human inside of you has died already. Something inside of you has died, which is very human, in order to deal with the human predicament. Think of Siddhartha Gautama, the founder of Buddhism. Left his wife and newborn baby so he could go out and find himself and become enlightened. And you might say, well, yeah, he started a religion or whatever. Yeah, Many, many deadbeat dads do that. They go out, they leave their wife and kids so they can go find themselves. The third noble truth of Buddhism is to cease having attachment and desire. And if you have attachment, this gets rid of any kind of suffering in your life. That's how you deal with suffering. See, different worldviews answer this differently, but by answering the problem, they actually kill the solution, which is love. I get rid of the despair by getting rid of love in the process. These solutions, frankly, I find to be horrific. I think if you're sitting here with us tonight and you're thinking about your own mortality, that you're going away, and it's forever. And that's not a debate. This is not up for debate. This is going to happen. This is in your future. Any one of these solutions cannot be the solution. However, Luc Ferry, our boy from the beginning of tonight, French secular philosopher, he says, compared to Christianity, whose promise of the resurrection of the body means that we shall be reunited with those we love after death, compared to that, a humanism without metaphysics is small beer. The translation doesn't quite translate. Small beer means beer with very little alcohol in it. So if this is supposed to be curative or palliative to the person, it's like drinking O'Doul's. You're like, it tastes like beer, but it's not beer, right? Humanism without metaphysics is small beer. Then he writes, I grant you that amongst the available doctrines of salvation, nothing can compete with Christianity, provided that is, you are a believer. What if I told you this medicine would cure your depression, your anxiety, your aches, your pains, your everything in your life, provided that you take it? What's stopping you from taking it? Yeah, if this is really true, and I believe it is, I don't think this is just wishful thinking. If this is really true, then you should accept this. As Solomon has said himself in chapter 3, the 11th verse, God has set eternity in the human heart. Do you have that sense that death is not the end? You're not just going to wind down and rot, but that you're going to continue to live. Do you have that sense? I sure do. I don't think this is going to be it. That's because God has placed that thought in your heart. You know, you could deny God, but it's still there, hardwired into you, that you're an eternal being. He says in chapter 12, the 7th verse, the dust will return to the earth, but the spirit will return to God who gave it. Oh, so that is the difference between us and the animals. He's saying, yeah, who knows? I'll tell you who knows. God knows that we will return to our creator. He concludes in chapter 12, verse 13, here now is my final conclusion. Fear God, that is, to fear is to revere, to respect, and obey his commands, for this is everyone's duty. God will judge us for everything that we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad. And here's the bad news. The good news is someone is watching and someone loves you and someone cares. It's not that your life is an audience of no one and then you just die, you fall over dead and everyone forgets you. The truth is there is someone there who's watched you from the moment you were born and took your first breath right up to this very moment. He's here with you right now. Jesus said, where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there. He is here with us right now. And he has seen everything you've ever done. And he's seen the good and he's seen the bad. And the problem is, what do we do with the bad? You know, I've talked to many people and I've asked this question. What do you do with your guilt? You know what I've never heard in response to that question? What guilt? Everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say, what do you do with your guilt? The question is, what do we do with that? What do we do with the good and the bad? Well, the good news, that's the bad news. The good news is that Jesus Christ came into the world to pay for every bad thing you've ever done, every bad choice, every person you've ever hurt, every individual you've ever morally violated and harmed. All of that was nailed up at the cross of Christ. And so, if you want to come to know God, Jesus is the only one who's ever paid for your moral violations. No one else. Buddha never paid for your moral violations. He never claimed to. Muhammad never paid for your moral violations. He never claimed to. The thought would be abhorrent to the historical Muhammad. Joseph Smith never paid for your moral violations. No world religion leader ever paid for your moral violations, nor claimed to. Only one. Jesus Christ. And if you choose to accept Christ into your life, he will fill your life with ultimate significance. He will fill your life with an anticipation of the future that builds with time. When the years turn into decades, you're going to be looking forward to meeting him more than ever. If you come to know Jesus Christ, you will never have to worry about what will happen when you die. That whole thought that we've been sitting on, this entire study here tonight, whew, gone. I mean, the worst that can happen to me is death, and then what? And then I go to be with God forever? Not even death will be able to rob you of your joy. I've seen many different Christians on their final days, their final weeks, right up when they're about to face the end. You wouldn't believe the difference between Christians that know Christ and have been following him and people that don't know God. The abject scariness, the terror of not knowing these answers versus people who know that they're secure. You wouldn't believe the difference between the two.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.